If you ask a group of randomly selected Americans, how secure do you feel today? You might be surprised at the results. People might say that they feel more confident that we're being protected from terrorist attacks. But are their lives as a whole more secure? And the answer to that is likely no. Because security is more than just the protection against terrorist attacks. It's one's health. It's one's economic well-being. It's public safety. All that comes together in how people view their own security.
But the U.S. government views security almost exclusively in terms of military might, spending around $1 trillion a year on a military they claim will shield Americans from harm. The reality is that even using this narrow interpretation of what it means to be safe, the government is losing the battle.
National security at the most basic level is about keeping the American people safe, but the threat to America's national security is greater right now than any other time in our lifetime.
For over 70 years, our leaders have told us one thing under the bright lights.
The protection of the lives and property of Americans is the responsibility of all public officials.
I care. We're trying.
And it is my first duty as president to protect the American people.
We have it so well under control.
But America's shadow government has spent trillions of dollars on secret plans that serve one premise. When the shit really hits the fan, we're on our own.
I have nothing, nothing.
And while we are dying in increasingly senseless ways, America's vast military machine never goes without. October 2017, Northwest Africa. American special forces are on patrol deep in the Niger Desert.
They were out on a patrol trying to find local affiliates of ISIS near the Mali border when they were ambushed.
The ambush was captured by a camera mounted on one of the soldiers' helmets.
When I watch that video, I think of the worst case scenario. When you go through training at Fort Benning as an infantryman, you think you'll never be left alone.
By the time helicopters were able to come in to rescue them, it was too late.
We always say, leave no man behind. And that video is American troops left behind, left to die. If we have drones and satellite eyes in space, how do we let American troops get abandoned? It's outrageous, and it's the epitome of how little, at times, our political leadership cares about the troops.
Suddenly that raised a lot of questions. What the hell were the soldiers doing in Niger in the first place?
Do the American people know they're there? And have they been asked whether it's the right thing to do? This is what happens when you have war without accountability.
I would not at this time draw any particular conclusion from the incident that happened yesterday. I think that it does reflect the fact, though, that we're having enormous success against the core, the very heart of this movement.
It really is a beautiful case of how the U.S. military really is out there in the world with very little knowledge back in the United States.
In 2017, America was planning a mission to Mars. The early phases of the Space Force were being developed. and American sons were being slaughtered in Niger by $50 AK-47s. We have prioritized weapon systems and defense contractors and the needs of corporate interests over the needs of our sons and daughters from Brooklyn, Detroit, and LA.
Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Since the end of the Cold War, the United States has been the world's undisputed superpower.
And while it's true that Russia has an equivalent number of nuclear weapons, they have a third world economy. And while it is true that China has a competitive economic strength of the United States, it has a third world military. And though they might be catching up, the truth of the matter is that no country is as powerful as the United States. No country has the capacity to wage war in the way that the United States wages it. And the United States is the sole superpower.
But it didn't come cheap. The United States possesses the most powerful military force ever assembled. And with 1.3 million active duty troops, over a million reservists, and almost 800,000 full-time civilians, the Department of Defense is the largest employer in the world. To maintain this vast military arsenal, the United States spends more on defense than the combined total of the next 10 countries.
A third of all, like, global military spending is done by our government. The military budget is over $700 billion, but if you add in the military work done by, like, the Department of Energy and other parts of the government, generally, estimates are that the real spending on military in the U.S. every year is about $1.2 trillion, enormous amounts of money.
You might think that the end of the Cold War would lead to, well, a peace, right? The country's been at war for decades. Now it's no longer a war. It can reinvest in welfare, in education, in infrastructure, in foreign aid. There's all kinds of things it can buy with its peace dividend.
You know, I remember the early 90s and the hopefulness. I mean, you had the end of the Cold War. You had the tearing down of the Berlin Wall. And the world could really have gone in a different direction.
All such hope for a peace dividend ended when the government took the American people back to war.
Well, after 9/11, President Bush declared a war on terror.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated.
What followed was a militarization both in the United States and abroad.
After 9/11, President Bush declared a national emergency, and he called up reservists and extended tours of duty and things like that, basically amplifying the military forces available to him for overseas deployment.
In October 2001, the first salvo in the American War on Terror was fired when U.S. forces attacked Afghanistan.
So you had a situation after 9/11 where you had a political leadership that was largely dominated by chicken hawks, people who had never served themselves and viewed people like me and others as pieces on a chessboard or a video game. In my view, it's the ultimate disrespect to our country. Our military is supposed to be used as a last resort, and it's not supposed to be abused.
And the war on terror becomes a new justification for the same old process, which is shoveling vast amounts of money towards the military, towards the spy agencies. And that's great for Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, all those firms. There was one famous conference call a couple years ago where a military contractor said, you know, war's not good for people, but man, it's really been great for business.
Since 9/11, defense contractors have seen their profits quadruple.
The war on terror is basically a welfare program for the military-industrial complex, the companies that provide the planes and the bombs, because it's incredibly profitable for weapons manufacturers. Just between 2016 and 2018, military spending went up 10%.
But many of the weapon systems that defense contractors supply are of little practical use to soldiers on the front lines in most conflicts.
We continue to dump billions of dollars in weapon systems like the F-35 that the military says they don't really need or don't want, yet the defense contractors continue to push.
Each F-35 fighter jet costs over $100 million. And with the entire program estimated to cost U.S. taxpayers over $1 trillion, it's the most expensive defense program ever.
It continues to fail to meet its objectives. It's delayed. It's over budget. If a human being was as bad at their job as the F-35 was, that person would be kicked out of the military a long time ago.
The infrastructure, the education, the healthcare, all of the things that we are failing in, they suddenly become disposable. Because we start asking Americans to sacrifice their well-being in the face of an opponent.
But who is that opponent? And why does it keep changing? And why are we still fighting?
The national emergency that was declared after 9/11 is still in place almost 20 years later and is being used for purposes that have nothing to do with 9/11.
Osama bin Laden wanted to draw us into a protracted war, to bleed us out. And George Bush fell for it. And we're still being bled out today. Osama bin Laden is long gone. But his objectives have been accomplished. His objectives continue to be furthered because we're still bleeding our blood, our treasure, our fabric of our country every single day. It's what brings down empires, and it's what could bring down America if we're not vigilant.
The idea behind these military bases is that they're there for security. But you have to ask the question, do they render the United States more secure? I think you can see some reasons why hundreds of military bases might actually be counterproductive. The major set of wars that the United States has been involved in the 21st century are under the rubric of the global war on terrorism. And how did that global war on terrorism start? The start of it, we usually say, is 9/11, when Al-Qaeda flew planes into the World Trade Center and into the Pentagon.
Yes, we're aware of the explosion. We heard that it was a plane down. Can you confirm?
I'm frustrated with the country as a whole. As long as we're going to let people off the hook in the Mideast, Iraq, Iran, and places like that, if we don't take a strong stand, this is going to continue.
This provoked a lot of shirt-rending in the United States. Why do they hate us, is the question that a lot of people ask. And the answer usually given, including given by President Bush, was they hate our freedoms, they hate our ideology. But that way of narrating it misses something really important, which is Osama bin Laden's reason.
Bin Laden's stated goal was clear, and so was his rally cry. He was able to use our presence in the Middle East as a way to motivate people around the world to fight us. It's something that most Americans can't understand. People don't attack us because they hate our freedom. They don't attack us even because they hate our president. They attack us because they think we're wrong and that they're right. They view themselves as freedom fighters against people who are imposing their will over their sacred land and their sacred space.
As part of the ongoing war on terror, the U.S. government has put American troops in harm's way across the globe.
We talk about places like Afghanistan and Iraq often, but we rarely talk about places like Syria or Somalia, where there are regularly American troops in danger, where our assets are being utilized. What started out as the war on terror has become the forever war. America's never-ending war with any number of enemies in any number of places, many of which Americans don't even know about, can't pronounce, or can't find on the map.
There is an armed conflict that we have been in since 2001 when Congress passed the authorization for use of military force, which authorized the president to use military force against those who planned 9/11 and who aided and abetted the planners. That really meant Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So it's become kind of a blank check for whatever war-making against terrorist organizations any administration wants to engage in.
In 2019, U.S. Special Operations Forces were at some point in that year in more than 140 countries. I mean, that's a majority of the countries on our planet.
And so we end up in the situation that we're in right now, where we're involved in a seemingly endless war in countries across the world that most Americans couldn't even name. They wouldn't even be able to tell you all of the countries in which we're at war right now.
The government's decision to deploy troops is often only revealed by tragedy.
When American troops died in Niger, most Americans didn't know we had American troops in Niger.
And the degree to which many of the operations that are happening are so secretive that even the American people are not aware who the enemy is that we're fighting, that's really a shocking state of affairs.
It's not just a forever war. It's an everywhere war. America is constantly at war everywhere around the globe. The sun never sets on our military operations because we have people in so many places around the world.
Key to our government's ability to wage war anywhere in the world at any time is a vast global network of military bases.
So the United States has fought the global war on terrorism with military bases. If you add up all the bases, the foreign bases that the United States maintains, we're talking about a number roughly at 750. So all the other countries in the world have roughly 40, and the United States, it's 750.
Some bases are so large, they resemble mini cities.
And those outposts get developed to the point where they feel like, as a lot of people call them, little Americas. You have Starbucks, you have McDonald's, you know, you have Star Trek fan clubs.
This network of overseas U.S. military bases dates back to the early days of the Cold War, when the United States was locked in a struggle for global supremacy with the Soviet Union. In 1962, the Cold War almost ended in Armageddon when Soviet nuclear missiles were discovered in Cuba.
I don't think the world has ever come closer to nuclear war than it did in the Cuban Missile Crisis. The President of the United States had said he was willing to go to war to get the Soviet nuclear missiles out of Cuba.
But the installation of Soviet missiles on the island is only half the story.
The part that we leave out is that from Moscow's perspective, the thing started when the United States put missiles in its bases in Turkey, pointed at the Soviet Union.
The U.S. had moved nuclear missiles into Turkey a year earlier, allowing America to destroy major Russian cities in minutes.
That, from Moscow's perspective, was the provocation and the reason that the Soviets retaliated by putting their missiles in Cuba.
As the American people prepared for nuclear war in 1962, they never knew the truth that their own government's decision to place nukes in Turkey could have killed them.
We call it the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think we might as well call it the Turkish Missile Crisis.
And while 60 years later these bases are seen as crucial in fighting the war on terror, they have enabled, perhaps even encouraged, our leaders to pursue a more reckless agenda that risks American lives.
We have to talk about what these military bases do to policy. If you have 750 foreign military bases spread around the world, military solutions come really easily to hand.
Iraq continues to flaunt its hostility toward America and to support terror. The Iraqi regime has plotted to develop anthrax and nerve gas and nuclear weapons for over a decade.
It becomes so easy in the United States to slip from this country is doing things that we in Washington don't like to something must be done.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world. The price of indifference would be catastrophic.
Before it was even decided and discovered who had carried out the attacks of September 11th, you had members of the Bush administration who were looking for an opportunity to get within Iraq and exercise regime change from Saddam Hussein.
Fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
In the months leading up to the invasion of Iraq, the Bush administration had argued Saddam Hussein possessed some of the world's most dangerous weapons, even hinting he had nuclear weapons, posing an existential threat to the United States.
Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
The pretext was the potential existence of weapons of mass destruction. In fact, the administration knew full well there was not any realistic threat that WMDs could be used in any way that would jeopardize the United States.
While the American people were being sold a lie, behind the scenes, plans were being made to reshape the balance of power in the region with seemingly little regard for the lives that would be lost.
And Iraq was a country that had long been a thorn in the side of the United States. George W. Bush's father had led military hostilities against Saddam Hussein after his army invaded the neighboring country of Kuwait.
It is not the United States against Iraq. It is Iraq against the world.
Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait in August 1990, annexing the country and its vast oil reserves. In response, the United States assembled a massive international coalition to drive Iraqi forces out of Kuwait. But while Saddam's armies were decimated, he remained in power. In the late 1990s, a small group of powerful Washington insiders from a little-known think tank began to call for regime change in Iraq.
So the Project for a New American Century is this brainchild of a group who continually call for America to go out and find the next crusade, to find the next big enemy that America can take on and define itself in opposite to. Because of the first Persian Gulf War, you see America understand that Saddam Hussein is an evil figure. They believe that he is the type of enemy that the American people will accept. So during the Clinton administration, this group are constantly lobbying Bill Clinton to fight Iraq. And they keep telling him this is the next big move in order to secure American security and American power.
But while the insiders failed to convince Clinton to invade, they found a willing partner in President George W. Bush.
Before it was even decided and discovered who had carried out the attacks of September 11th, you had members of the Bush administration who were looking for an opportunity to get within Iraq and exercise regime change from Saddam Hussein.
It's worth noting that there was relatively little discussed about what would happen after.
I don't know how long we're going to be here, but if we'll be here for a while, it's going to be hard.
You get rid of Saddam, you get rid of his lieutenants, then what? And the big question about how are you going to govern this country? How are you going to rebuild it? Wasn't something that was much discussed in Washington in the run-up to the war, but it would come to bedevil us for years to come.
And would end up killing thousands of American troops. But at first, all seemed to be going well for U.S. forces.
Within 3 weeks, U.S. forces were in Baghdad. Saddam Hussein's government had melted. And in some quarters in Washington, there was a feeling that a mission had been accomplished.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
But for those of us in Baghdad, it was clear that we had just finished the first chapter of what was going to be a very long book. And the reality is the furthest thing from mission accomplished.
I got to the city of Baghdad at the same time the president said the mission was accomplished.
Paul Rykoff was an infantry officer in the National Guard, stationed in one of the city's most dangerous neighborhoods.
We arrived with no body armor, with no adequate vehicles, without water. We didn't have enough water to go around. The most powerful army in the world has ever seen. And we had to scrap for ammunition and body armor.
But the troops were rushed into the region without adequate equipment on the back of lies told about weapons of mass destruction.
Our vehicles are not armored. We're digging pieces of rusted scrap metal to put onto our vehicles to take into combat.
As you know, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have at a later time.
The Bush administration also claimed they'd be greeted as liberators.
Yeah.
Now, soldiers like Paul Rykoff found themselves occupiers in an increasingly hostile land.
Only someone who's never experienced war thinks that it's quick and easy and simple. War is complicated, war is messy, war is expensive, war is painful.
The ones that are fighting truly believe in their cause just as we do. When we were fighting for our independence, we fought like the Indians. The man will fight with whatever he has at hand.
Ulama wa izzat Muhammad, law nadu hayya ala jihad.
As the insurgency started to pick up in intensity, U.S. forces were totally unprepared. And importantly, they were unprepared in terms of equipment. In many cases, soldiers would drive around in Humvees, in four-wheel drive vehicles, that lacked any meaningful protection against small arms fire or roadside bombs.
As anarchy and violence quickly consumed Iraq, the political elites found sanctuary in a fortified compound.
So while they were in air-conditioned bunkers, we were in the streets bleeding and dying.
In the months after U.S. forces arrived, Washington realized, hey, we actually need to send some people over to try to govern, administer, and rebuild this country. And so the U.S. needed a headquarters in Baghdad. And it turned pretty quickly to the large compound that housed Saddam Hussein's Republican Palace, right smack dab in the center of Baghdad. Now, this place soon got a name. In contrast to the Red Zone, the dangerous Iraq all around it, this area inside was called the Green Zone.
The Green Zone quickly became a 4-square-mile piece of America in the heart of Baghdad.
You could go jogging on the streets. You could get, you know, bacon cheeseburgers and other such things that weren't available, you know, in Iraqi restaurants, and you could get a drink.
Well, I didn't know there was going to be a stakeout here.
My unit was on the other side of the river from the Green Zone. So while these guys were sleeping in palatial palaces and walking around in suits, saying there was no insurgency, that we were winning the war, that we were being treated as liberators, we were facing hostility and riots and the manifestation of what would become the insurgency.
And so the Green Zone was like not only a fantasy, it became part of the problem, that elites could insulate themselves from the destruction that they had wrought, and they could pursue their silly ideas that Iraq was going to quickly turn into a miniature version of America.
People who thought we were going to roll into Iraq and make it look like New Jersey were dangerously disconnected and out of touch with the reality. Iraq is never going to look like New Jersey, but Iraq is a place that motivated hundreds of thousands of mostly young men to come and fight against us
and kill Americans. While U.S. soldiers began to feel the brunt of a growing insurgency, corporations were raking in profits by the billions.
The great American General Smedley Butler once said, "War is a racket." And Iraq was definitely a racket. And the American troops were not in on it. The American troops had to scrape and scrap for everything while other guys were getting rich, while companies like Halliburton were getting no-bid contracts.
Private companies made an estimated $140 billion from the conflict, securing lucrative contracts in private security, reconstruction, and oil production.
War shouldn't be about profit. War should be a last resort, and it should be something that we try to end as quickly as possible. It shouldn't be a bonanza for scumbags to come in and get rich, and that's what we saw. We saw scumbags and grifters come in and get rich off Iraq while we lost our legs and our friends. So that cuts to maybe the most outrageous part of America's involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan, is that some people gave everything, and others got rich. They want the war to go on so they can make more money and buy champagne. That cuts to the core of how unequal it was and how dangerous it was for our national security to have the profit motive introduced on a level we'd never seen before.
Major American combat operations in Iraq eventually wound down in December 2011. The war cost taxpayers an estimated $2 trillion. But the cost to Americans went way beyond the dollars spent.
Approximately 4,500 U.S. service members would be killed in action. Tens of thousands would come home injured, some of them gravely, missing limbs, suffering from traumatic brain injuries, racked by post-traumatic stress.
We're really good at sending people to war, and we're really good at paying to send people to war. We're really bad at bringing people home and taking care of them once they get back. Guys like Paul Wolfowitz and Don Rumsfeld said, you go to war with the army you have. That's right. And then you come home to the VA you have. And when I went to war with the army we had, I came home to the VA we had, which was a VA that didn't know how to take care of women, didn't know how to treat post-traumatic stress disorder, didn't know about roadside bombs, didn't know about ear injuries and the other kinds of wounds we were facing. And already we've lost more people to suicide than we've lost on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we will lose many more in the decades to come.
In the vacuum left by the removal of Saddam's regime and the end of a major U.S. military presence, extremism flourished, and many more lives would be lost.
So you get ISIS after about 10 or 11 years of the crisis caused by the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and ISIS is a real threat to regional stability.
The fight against ISIS has claimed tens of thousands more Iraqi lives, with millions losing their homes and way of life. But it has done something else, kept the business of war going.
This has been produced by the supposedly the attempt to make the world safe with U.S. military means, but it produces insecurity, and then that insecurity justifies more of the same military intervention and spending.
Our government has spent trillions of dollars over the last two decades fighting perceived enemies across the globe. But has it really made us safer?
And then once you guys are out, I can take the mask off?
Yes.
Okay.
We've disproportionately allocated our resources, and not just money, but really our attention. And so for years, preparing for a global pandemic was something that was shockingly under-resourced, not just in terms of money and equipment, but in terms of the time and thinking of senior policymakers.
February 29th, 2020. The first confirmed death from COVID-19 is reported in the United States.
Unfortunately, one person passed away overnight.
On the very same day, over 7,000 miles away, the U.S. government signs a peace deal with the Taliban, highlighting a grim reality. Since American troops were first sent to Afghanistan in 2001, that war has raged on, while problems that threaten the lives of Americans back home have been ignored.
So February 2020, there was supposedly a peace agreement signed. But there's been no peace for American soldiers for 19 years. There's been no peace for the Afghans for 19 years. And there's no peace in the region.
That compound right there.
The original mission of the Afghan war was aimed at toppling the Taliban government so that the United States and allied forces would be able to kill or capture the top leadership of Al-Qaeda, specifically Osama bin Laden.
And Afghanistan has become the place that Osama bin Laden hoped it would become. The place that would suck in the American military, that would suck in our blood and treasure, that would take our eye off the ball. And Afghanistan is in some ways part of the reason why we can't prepare adequately for a pandemic. If we hadn't fought the war in Afghanistan, think about how much better prepared we could have been for the coronavirus.
For years, preparing for a global pandemic was something that was shockingly under-resourced, not just in terms of money and equipment, but in terms of the time and thinking of senior policymakers.
But where is the PPE? Where are the ventilators?
And it's a sad reflection
on this society that we have the greatest, most powerful military in the history of mankind, and yet nurses have had to wear garbage bags to protect themselves from patients in hospitals.
The pandemic is hurting America in ways that Osama bin Laden could have only dreamed of, and, in my view, is the greatest modern threat to our national security we've ever seen.
But the pandemic isn't the only threat to national security that the ongoing war in Afghanistan has distracted us from.
When you look at the most significant attack that has been perpetrated against Americans in recent years, it was a cyber attack in 2016.
Hello! Hello!
Election interference by the Russians. A concerted campaign of misinformation, of disinformation, targeted at American voters.
We viewed Russia as a regional power, very famously. You know, that's what President Obama called Russia, much to Putin's chagrin. We thought that Russia is not a threat to us. Russia's military is not a threat to us. Therefore, there's no way that Russia can undermine the United States. And we were too late to recognize this threat. I think we were distracted by, for instance, the war on terror.
We'll never know conclusively whether those attacks resulted in President Trump's election, but it was the most significant attack directed against the United States, and one that we continue to be woefully unprepared to defend.
Just recently, Twitter was hacked by a 17-year-old. We're lucky that that hacker just used it to get himself some Bitcoin and not start a nuclear war.
I think that we've started to realize that not only can our government not take care of us in a way that we would expect them to, but they can't even carry out the basic necessity of taking care of our national security.
Security is about the lives of Americans, and those threats are more than just bombs or hijacked airplanes. It's microscopic virus particles. It's potential cyber attacks. For Americans to feel truly secure, they need not just that sort of physical security. They need to know that they have security when it comes to their health.
We may get to the point where more people are killed by COVID in the United States than were killed in the Second World War.
We're dying constantly in just really overtly incompetent ways. And I think that it's making it obvious that this government that has completely sold itself on its ability to protect us has failed in every regard.
This is what happens when there is a shadow agenda, a shadow America that benefits one group of people at the expense of the greater good. All they need is for you not to pay attention. All they need is for you not to know where America's sons and daughters are dying, or how much money they spend on a weapon system, or where they're deploying troops. They hope you don't pay attention. If you don't pay attention, that's how this happens. That's how billions of dollars are spent. That's how cities are left vulnerable. That's how pandemics spread.
And so it's maybe a time for us to rethink about what makes us safe and what really endangers us.
We kind of had a phrase decades ago in the prep industry called 72 hours to animal. We don't believe that anymore. We believe it's more like 72 seconds or 72 minutes to animal. Chaos is going to break out within the first hour or hours. Rich people in government, they take care of themselves. But for the middle class and for lower income folks, you're absolutely on your own. Government's number one priority is taking care of themselves. Police number one priority, continuity of government, taking care of the elected officials.
Back up! Back up!